Hello there, scaredy cats. Welcome to a very special episode of F This Movie. It is October 1st, which means that today kicks off our all horror month on F This Movie. And joining me for this very special episode, F These Movies for All Hallows Eve, is the man who knows more about horror movies than anyone else, JB.
It's true. And I have a pocket full of $100 bills because I've been waiting all year for the All Whore Podcast. I'm ready to pay the whores. And we have proof that this is the perfect podcast for the Halloween season, and that just a couple minutes ago, the software that is recording our voices started all by itself. As Patrick chimes in with the fake theremin, we suggest that this laptop, ladies and gentlemen, is haunted. Can you prove that it didn't happen?
It's horror month on F This Movie. And we have a couple of special things going on for horror month, not only this show, but at our website, fthismovie.blogspot.com, all month long, we are doing the F Horror Challenge. And what that is anybody who listens to the show should visit our site at fthismovie.blogspot.com. Anytime you watch a horror movie during the month of October, find the post that says F Horror Movie Challenge. And in the comments section, post a 7-word review. Give the title of the movie and a seven-word review. No more, no less. And our goal is to get over 100 movies by the end of the month from all of our listeners.
Yes, we would like the review to be the haiku of horror, as it were.
And the really good ones we'll read on the show throughout the month of October as we discuss a number of horror movies. Coming up next week is another very special show where JB and I are going on a very special journey.
It could be many things and many journeys. I'm not exactly sure what you're... Oh!
We're going up to the mountains.
We're going skiing! Biff, Sonny, grab your gear!
Next weekend here in Chicago is the Music Box Massacre, a 24-hour horror marathon held at the Music Box Theater, which we talk about a lot on this show.
The happiest place on earth.
And they do it every year. And JB and I will be attending for 24 hours straight so that we can come back the next day and talk about not only the 12 or so movies that we saw,
but also the experience.
But also the experience of 24 hours inside a movie theater.
The sights, the sounds, the smells. It's true. And if you live in the Chicago area, you have to go to the massacre. You cannot say that you love film and not attend the massacre. So here, you puts in your nickel and you takes your choice. You can go to the massacre and then listen to the podcast about the massacre, or you cannot go to the massacre, although then you're not my friend, and you can still listen to the podcast about the massacre. And we want to give a shout out to Rusty Nails, who's the man behind the massacre. And this was all his idea, all of his ball of wax 6 years ago, and Chicago thanks him. It's the greatest thing ever.
Yeah, every year he puts together a great, great lineup. This year's lineup includes The Wolfman.
The original.
The original. Fright Night, Psycho.
Both of which are having anniversaries. And he's also showing the Lon Chaney Sr. Phantom of the Opera.
Yes, he does a silent movie every year with live organ accompaniment.
Which is always fun.
The Raven.
Funhouse, which is a...
Toby Hooper movie?
Seldom screened, yeah. Toby Hooper movie.
Pet Sematary.
House by the Cemetery.
Still the scariest movie I've ever seen. Pet Sematary really is.
Are you serious?
The sister in Pet Sematary, Aunt Zelda. We've talked about this, haven't we?
No.
Do you remember Pet Sematary? The sister with like some spinal condition in the bed. It has nothing to do with the rest of the movie. It's just a flashback that the wife tells.
Yeah.
The scariest thing I've ever seen in a movie.
Well, that's interesting.
It haunts me.
I always hold Pet Sematary up for another reason.
Right.
Because it does something that I hate when horror films do.
We will talk about that.
Which is mess with children.
On the F the Music Box Massacre podcast coming next week.
Yeah, and again, I can't say this enough. You should attend, and you should listen to F This Movie, and you should do everything I say.
As always, you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. If you have a favorite horror movie you want to write about, or if you too were scared shitless by Aunt Zelda in Pet Sematary, I would like to know about it because of solidarity. Tonight we are talking about, to kick off Horror Movie Month on If This Movie, we thought it would be a good idea to talk about some of the best horror movies ever made. Do I have that right? Because I feel like my list bounces around from here's one that I think is the best, here's one that is my favorite, here's one that I want to watch every Halloween.
Well, the problem with every best list is that it's hopelessly subjective and hopelessly personal. Although I was telling Patrick earlier in the evening that when I actually sat down and gave this way too much thought, I was surprised at how conventional my choices are, which led me to the conclusion that most horror films are awful. Awful with a capital A.
Yes.
And it's surprising when you think that of all the genres, and I think I can say this without fear of rebuttal, of all the genres, horror movies have the most rabid fans.
Yeah.
So in a weird
horror
way.
Horror movies and romantic comedies. You know those diehard romantic comedy fans.
Those rom-com guys with their rom-com conventions. How many conventions can Meg Ryan do in 1 year? That a horror has these rabid fans and fan conventions and people who are really into it and sort of live it. And it's ironic because there are so few that are truly great. There's so much dross that it's almost as if at a very young age, you got a taste of something really good. And for the rest of your life, you decided to chase the dragon with other films that don't give you the fix that you're looking for. That being said, I think usually when magazines run the 10 best horror films, the same titles come up again and again and again, because there aren't a lot of great ones. Likewise, we're also going to talk about the worst horror films ever made, in our opinion. And the whole genesis behind this was that I think around Halloween, people get a taste for scary movies, and people start renting scary movies and downloading scary movies and streaming scary movies. So I think our best choices would be great choices to watch in the Halloween season, or if you're putting together a little film festival in your living room, these would be good choices. And obviously the worst films should be avoided.
Yeah. Honestly, avoid it. Don't seek them out ironically. Don't spend your night watching a terrible horror movie because it's hilarious.
And that's interesting.
Just terrible.
Because most lists of the worst horror films ever made would probably include Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Right.
Which I do not include.
No.
Because it is only watched ironically.
Right.
And even if you're not watching it ironically, I don't think it's one of the worst horror films ever made for many reasons, but it reminds me of a couple years ago we were thinking of actually taking an ironic vacation to Branson, Missouri.
Yeah.
We were going to go there to make fun of it. And my son, who is very wise, said, "Why would you want to spend your time
right.
and your money
right.
on shit?"
right.
So that you can smirk at it?
To feel superior for 5 days.
Stay home and right. smirk at right. the carpet or something.
Right.
So, Patrick's right. The worst are truly the worst, but I believe we're going to start with the best.
Yeah. Do you want to name your first?
Are we going in descending order or ascending order?
Okay. I'll be honest. I did not rank mine. I just went like chronologically. But if you have a ranking, then that would be great.
I did put some time into a ranking.
Okay, no, that's great. I didn't even think of ranking mine. I just was trying to pick five, and I had a hard time.
But that only points out how subjective it is.
Sure.
And part of this is influenced by the fact that I am a film study teacher. I teach a high school film study class in Upper Minnesota, and I do a unit on the genre. And so some of these films I've seen 80 or 90 times in class. With a continuing, with an ever-changing group of young people
right.
who I'm sort of able to bounce the films off of, and they give me their feedback and we discuss them. And I think that gives me some insight. But obviously, every list is subjective. So let's forget about ranking. Let's forget about chronology. And let's just talk about the films.
Okay.
So at this point, it resembles a poker game. I am literally holding my card close to my chest. Patrick is holding his Word document close to his laptop.
Well, but here's the thing. I
think you should go first.
You do. Okay, and that's fine. I will. But again, I almost wrote my list sort of in reaction to yours. We didn't share our lists ahead of time.
We have not seen either. Well, I've seen mine. Wait, let me rephrase that. We have not seen the other person's list.
I've never seen a horror movie. So my number five is Bullet. We had spoken very briefly, and JB said that his was kind of conventional, and that these are the top five for a reason. And so I sort of made my list almost in response to that, because I deliberately was trying to A, predict what would be on his list, and B, choose different films so you get 10 movies instead of five.
True. And this is going to be like a magic trick. Because his list was written in reaction to something he hasn't seen.
That's right.
So we both put a card down, and it turns out to be the same film.
But that's why you have to go first, I think. Because I have to see if I'm right each time. Do you know what I mean?
Okay,
so this is a fun game for everyone listening, isn't it?
So basically, we're going to share what we think are the best horror films ever made. And Patrick will see if he's right, guessing with the old man. Thanks. So, once again, in no particular order, because these films are masterpieces, in the words of Bill Hicks, I can prove that on an Etch-a-Sketch. Film number one, in no particular order, Halloween.
Okay.
It is an amazing film.
Okay.
Given its low-budget status, as I point out to my students, the semesters I show it, it's a beautiful film to look at.
Yeah.
The lighting is amazing. It's all blue and orange, and it's very great to look at. The screenplay is tops. There are passages in the film. I always go back to Donald Pleasance's monologue, that what I saw there was evil. I spent 10 years trying to reach him, and then another 10 trying to keep him locked behind doors. That whole monologue. Is great. I think it's got one of the great last lines in horror movie history. Although later that ending idea is co-opted in other horror films where they just want to make sequels.
Right.
But if you consider that no one associated with Halloween had any idea that it was going to become the hit or the franchise that it did. And so if you regard it on its own, the ending is very chilling. I think anyone listening to this podcast knows how Halloween ends, but...
Two things. One, I already got that one wrong. And two, I thought it was a possibility, but I wasn't sure. That's not one that I predicted. But two, that's a great pick because A, obviously Halloween is the movie that inspired scores of imitators. It essentially invented the slasher movie genre, which consists almost entirely of just miserable shit. But two, it takes place on Halloween.
And it got so ridiculous during that golden time, which I would actually now call the time between Night of the Living Dead and Nightmare on Elm Street is what I consider to be the Silver Age.
Okay.
I don't know what caused it, although I have some theories, but if you consider between 1931 and 1942, the golden age of universal horror, where we get all the monsters that you'll still see walking around every Halloween, some series of circumstances and histories and peoples conspired to give us just and the proof is in the pudding, because now what we're seeing is remakes of all of those 70s and early 80s films.
Right.
What was it that conspired? There's a documentary that all of you should see. The Independent Film Channel did it a few years ago. It's called The American Nightmare. And one of the things the film suggests at the end is that all the filmmakers we're talking about John Carpenter, David Cronenberg, John Landis, George Romero, and to a lesser extent, Tobe Hooper, all grew up post-war during the Cold War and the resurgence of the Universal monsters in the 60s. For some reason, there was this explosion of nostalgic interest in the Universal
monsters. Probably the monsters.
Perhaps. And that for some reason, that led to these amazing horror films being made for about a decade. And I just realized I left out Wes Craven, and of course you can't leave him out. Halloween is a beautiful film to look at. Great performances, great script. It's still really scary.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Further proof of that is the fact that Scream is basically a variation on a theme for its final 20 minutes, that all of the horror stuff in Scream is occurring while the kids are watching Halloween on TV, and the film even plays with that. It's a variation on a theme. And I just remember the Donald Pleasance line that I like so much from his monologue. He had the darkest eyes, the devil's eyes. And maybe I'm just attuned to this because I remember when we did the podcast on the Wolfman remake, which isn't really doesn't have that great dialogue. That the Wolfman has this one line that sort of sticks out as being something that you'll file away in your personal filing cabinet. But I noticed that all of the films I put on the best list have dialogue that's just very memorable. And lately when I go to the movies, because we've talked about the fact that this has been a very bad year for movies.
Yes.
If someone says, oh, I saw that last weekend, I really liked it, your question might be, give me one memorable line of dialogue from that film.
Right.
And I think for most movies this year, people would be hard-pressed to do it. So one great horror film. Another criteria, it is endlessly repeatable.
Yeah.
I could sit down right now and watch it again.
Right. I, again, in attempting to sort of predict what you might say, I went with a different John Carpenter movie. Though Halloween certainly belongs on any list, I went somewhere between what I think is one of the best and one of my favorites, and that is his remake of The Thing, which is a movie that, while I won't necessarily make the argument it's better than Halloween, I prefer it to Halloween. It's one that I...
It's a great film.
It's unbelievably great.
In every which way. And I remember, I think recently I revisited it and the documentary, which for some strange reason is on the standard DVD, but not on the Blu-ray. Boo. And that I remember seeing The Thing the weekend it opened and no one had ever seen anything like it. Rob Bottin special effects. And in the documentary, they point out that that was the same summer that E.T. was released.
No one went to see it.
And people were not in the mood for The Thing.
Right. They want nice, friendly alien who eats your Reese's Pieces, not the alien who takes your hands off and, you know, kills your dog.
It's true. And the moment I love to recapture in my memory is the fact that we're seeing all these special effects, these magnificent, grotesque splatter effects. And, of course, this is pre-CGI, so it's physical effects. Mm-hmm. They're actually doing it with foam rubber and acetone and all these things. And, of course, there's a scene where a head lowers itself down a table on tendrils of muscles, grows spider legs, and scuttles across the floor. And the audience as a whole, as a unit, our jaws are dropping open, and then a character on the screen perfectly captures what everyone in the theater is thinking. He turns his head, sees the spider head leg thing, and says, "You gotta be fucking kidding me." It is one of the transcendent moments in horror cinema. And actually, putting the list together, I realized why John Carpenter is in every documentary ever made about horror films.
Two of the best horror movies ever made.
And a whole bunch of other films that are not slouches.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, the last two decades probably have not been great for him. But for a while, you know, he was pretty tops. Yeah, I love The Thing. It's a great monster movie. It's an unbelievably sort of bleak and nihilistic movie, which is, I think, why it didn't do great at the box office the first time. But I like also that it's a movie that sort of got a second life on cable, and people started to rediscover it and say, holy shit, this is a really great movie. And it's sort of the quintessential John Carpenter movie in that it's his most Hawksian, you know?
Yes, very much.
Even
more than Assault on Precinct which a lot of people think is the most like Howard Hawks.
Because it's he's ripping off Rio Bravo. Right?
Another reason to love The Thing, no women. No women. No women at all.
It's a great, great, great movie that I like a lot.
Great horror film.
Yes.
The Exorcist.
Okay.
Which I have often called the scariest movie ever made.
Yes.
I have never shown it in class because I think it would be cruel to expect young people to sit through it for a grade, given that it's not about a crazy guy in a mask or some creature. It's about something that some people take really seriously. Sure, sure, and I don't want to mucky muck with people's religion.
Sure.
When it was re-released a couple years ago in the version you've never seen.
Which is the only version I've ever seen. The only version I've ever seen is the version I've never seen.
Which is a shame.
Yeah.
Because they really went bull goose loony in the reimagined one. And Captain Howdy just appears everywhere. And in the original, the Captain Howdy stuff, and by that I mean the subliminal flashes of this death's head, which was actually stuntwoman Eileen Dietz wearing a test makeup. It shows up most notably in Karras's dream, where he goes to bed drunk and he imagines that he sees his mother across a busy street going down into a subway tunnel, and there's a brief flash, and then there's this incredibly scary face that will knock your socks off. And in the version you've never seen, it's the version you've never seen, and now you've seen Captain Howdy way too much. I mean, he shows up on the stove hood at one point. He's just it's like they went through the film and said, where can we put Captain Howdy some more? But I got to see it in a theater because they re-released it,
right.
And I had never seen it in a theater before. And the show I saw was full of young people, and I thought their reaction was really interesting. And I might be overthinking this, but at certain points, they all laughed. And I may be wrong, but I sense that this was protective laughter.
Yeah.
That the film was touching them in a way that they didn't want to be touched, and they were protecting themselves against it. It's an amazing film, amazing direction. It took them so long to shoot because they were doing the possessed bedroom in an ice house to get the breath to show, and it's all physical effects. The documentary on that disc, which is called The Fear of God, which was put together by Mark Kermode, who's like the world's leading exorcist expert, is well worth your time, and I still maintain it's the scariest movie ever made.
A lot of people, I think, say that, and I need to see it again because it's been a while. And although I remember the version you've never seen, was the sequence where she gets the spinal tap new to that version, or is that in the original?
They extended one of the medical sequences,
okay.
But the spinal tap was in the original because when it was originally released in the early 70s, that was one of the scenes that people found it hardest.
That, for me, was the one that messed me up the most.
It's very, very hard to watch.
Yeah. And I thought that was a new scene, but it's a great movie, and one of the things that's great about it is the way that Friedkin directs it, as though it never sort of acknowledges the fact that it's a horror movie, that it treats all of this as though it's absolutely happening for real, and that is, I think, what's great about that movie.
Which producer William Peter Blatty, who wrote the novel, said that one of the reasons why he chose Friedkin is that Friedkin had just directed The French Connection, which was very documentary-like in a lot of ways.
Right.
It was very gritty because, in fact, Friedkin got his start making documentaries in Chicago. I think that's a really good point, though. It doesn't tip its hand. It doesn't cloak itself in the trappings of horror films.
Right.
In fact, if you watch the first 10 or 15 minutes, you might think, what is this film have I walked into?
But even Halloween is very heavily stylized, and The Exorcist isn't really. It's very sort of straightforward. This is happening.
And of course, physical effects and no CGI.
My next movie is a movie that would not have appeared on my list if we did this a year or two ago, but is a movie that has grown tremendously in my estimation in the last year or so, and that is The Shining. Which is a movie that I always thought was okay, but never loved. And again, rediscovered sort of in the past year or so, and partially thanks to Blu-ray, because of course the Blu-ray has it in a different aspect ratio, which to me makes a huge difference. Yeah. I know that's getting super specific and nerdy, but if you bought the old DVD, it was in sort of a standard full-frame TV format, which there's some debate as to whether or not that's exactly what Kubrick intended, but the Blu-ray opens it up to a more it's more like a movie screen. We won't get into aspect ratio nerdiness.
But that is the way it was presented, because, when again, the weekend that opened, I saw it twice.
Wow.
With two different groups of friends. And I think this is the only time I've ever done this in a movie. The second time I saw it, knowing when a really scary part was coming, we were in the third row. I turned around and watched the audience see that happen.
Yeah.
And I won't give it away, but it was great. The Shining is also interesting because it was the first book that scared me. I remember reading the book, and there's things going on with these topiary animals in the book, shrubs that are trimmed to look like animals. And Jack, the protagonist, thinks he sees them move at one point, and he's not sure. And maybe it was just because I was a teenager, but it really, really scared me. That's interesting, because that's one of the first things Kubrick jettisons in the movie, knowing that could never work in a film.
Right.
That is strictly the province of literature.
Right.
He replaces it with a hedge maze to similar effect. But the other thing interesting about The Shining is when it came out, Stephen King was very outspoken about how much he didn't like it for various reasons. And then many years later, he writes a version for TV. There's a remake for TV that is unwatchable.
Yeah. Yeah, it's terrible. And I know, I mean, the central thing that he sort of seems to be trying to correct is that the whole thing is a metaphor for alcoholism, because he was an alcoholic when he wrote it. And so the father in the TV remake starts out as just sort of very normal and, you know, goes crazy sort of over time. And one of Stephen King's big problems with the Kubrick version, which I'll admit is still kind of a problem, is the lead performance by Jack Nicholson. When he goes crazy, he's great. Nobody does crazy like Jack Nicholson. But even watching it again, you know, today, the whole first hour of the movie, when he's not supposed to be batshit nuts yet, you can tell that he already is. He still plays that first hour like a crazy person.
Yeah.
And it's obvious that even the first hour of the movie, that his wife and son live in fear of him. And some of that is explained because
there were some incidents in the
exactly.
past.
But it again, to use the expression, tips its hand a little early.
True, but I think given what we find out at the very end of the film, it makes perfect sense that he's that way a little bit from the beginning.
Sure.
It's as if Nicholson's performance is informed by the fact that he's read the entire script to the last page.
Right.
Although for the longest time I thought, before I revisited the film, because Rusty showed it at a massacre a couple years ago, that The Shining was the film where Nicholson learned that people really like to see him overact.
Right.
And it opened a can of worms for performances of which I'm not a big fan.
Right.
But, you know, the scene that they always show in compilations, the scene they always show on television when the film is brought up, the Give Me the Bat Wendy scene, is amazing. Because like most horror films, it's talking about a whole bunch of things under the disguise of spooky possession.
And rewatching it, I'm always amazed at the scene where Scatman Crothers gets axed, and I can't imagine what that would have been like. You know, if you had never read the book, if you're seeing the movie in 1981, here is this sympathetic character that you're positive is coming to save Wendy and Danny. And before he can do anything, he is just brutally, brutally done away with.
And that's the scene that I turned around in the theater to watch people watch.
Oh, and the one you said you weren't going to spoil, and I just did.
I watched him get it in the chest. Shining because really, fans. The law of conservation of characters suggests that the whole reason his character is introduced is to have a black knight riding in at the end to save Danny. And man, when he gets in the chest, Kubrick saying, all bets are off.
Yeah. Anyway, that's a great movie and one that I've really fallen in love with over the last year or so.
And if I could just throw this in for 30 seconds, the twin girls.
Sure.
One of the creepiest. And it's interesting because the advertising all revolved around this famous shot of all the blood coming out of the elevator.
Which is still unbelievable, by the way.
Which is visually interesting, but there is nothing creepier than those two girls.
There is something creepier than the two girls, and it's Aunt Zelda in Pet Sematary, which, again, is an otherwise bad movie that features the scariest thing I've ever seen.
Because we want you to listen to this podcast forever and ever and ever.
Next film on my list.
Yes.
And in fact, many years ago at a famous Monsters of Film Man convention in California, they had a big poll among people who should know about these things. And this is the film that won at that convention for best horror film. 1935, The Bride of Frankenstein.
Yeah. That really, I think, is the answer. And I didn't pick it for that reason, but if you had to say, what's the best horror movie ever made? I think the answer is probably The Bride of Frankenstein.
Very hard to get young people to watch it.
That's incredible, because I think that movie absolutely holds up.
And in terms of contemporary goth teenagers, you think they would like it, because there is no film more goth and twisted and weird.
And funny. And I think all that humor still comes through decades later. So that's upsetting to hear that people don't want to watch it.
You could just list the things that are clever and funny. The fact that Dr. Pretorius, twisted Dr. Pretorius, keeps telling us a different thing that's his only weakness, which makes us wonder how many weaknesses he has. The other reason I thought The Bride of Frankenstein deserves a place on the list, besides the fact that it's The Bride of Frankenstein, is that very quickly in the Universal Monster cycle, Frankenstein gets relegated to this secondary status where he is comatose through 75% of the film. He is revived to stumble about for 10 minutes and then fall in quicksand or sulfur or a swamp or to get burned up in a fire two different times. And Bride of Frankenstein gives us a lot of the monster.
Yeah.
Doing things and talking and having interactions.
And very little of the Bride of Frankenstein.
But the bride is relegated to 10 minutes.
Right.
But I can still remember the first time I saw the film, and at the end of the film, as the monster is about to bring everything crashing down, the Bride of Frankenstein, played by Elsa Lanchester, looks at him and hisses. And it is just the most batshit crazy thing you can imagine at that moment.
That's some cold shit.
Although later I learn she got the idea from the swans in this park where she and her husband Charles Lawton used to frequent. If you got close to their young, that's the way they would try to intimidate you or drive you off. That she got that from the hissing of the swans. Again, amazing dialogue. I love the dead, hate the living, to which Pretorius replies, "You're wise in your generation." There aren't many films even now that are as dark at their core as The Bride of Frankenstein. But again, very entertaining, very funny. I think it says a lot, as I discovered as I looked over my list, that very often horror films say a lot about loneliness. That there's this thread running through of you know, what loneliness can do to a person.
I absolutely knew that movie would be on your list, so I did not put it on mine. And I went with a different Universal Monster movie that is flawed, but I still think has great things about it, and that is the Todd Browning Dracula. And part of it is just because it was sort of the first of the Universal Monster wave and sort of created the whole genre, you know, sort of. But also because there are sections of that movie that are tedious, that are slow, but it is still, I think, one of the most atmospheric horror movies ever made. It has, you know, the iconic performance by Bela Lugosi, and no matter when, you know, every October I want to put it on just to hear that opening score. I'm instantly in the mood. It is October. Halloween is coming. I'm watching Dracula, and all is right with the world.
For about 20 years, I held the opinion that's way too popular, that it is static and stagey and stage-bound, and I was tragically hip about it. And last February, Toy John showed it at the Portage as part of a marathon, and I watched it again with new eyes, and I really thought it played.
Yeah.
Clearly, the reason you're there is Lugosi.
Right.
Although Dwight Frye as Renfield is just an amazing thing. And again, to continue this theme that we're talking about, amazingly memorable dialogue. Listen to them. Children of the night. What music they make. And it's been suggested that at that point in time, Lugosi wasn't very well versed in English.
Right.
And learned his lines phonetically.
Right.
But if that's true, I think what you get is a performance where he doesn't stress the words that someone who spoke English would stress. And so that identifies him as foreign and as the
right.
other.
Right.
Often imitated, never duplicated. I completely had my head turned around about the original Dracula. How can you say anything's boring that's less than 80 minutes long?
Right. I mean, absolutely. It does go by quickly.
It's a swift thing.
And Todd Browning was a crazy man.
In more ways than one. I'm trying to remember the name of the book. David J. Skahl has written a biography of Todd Browning.
Yes. Dark Carnival?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was nuts, man.
Right. I came very close to putting Freaks on the list, too, but Freaks doesn't quite qualify as a horror movie to me. I don't know what genre you would put Freaks in, but Freaks is amazing.
I think we might classify Freaks under the same heading as David Lynch's Eraserhead,
yeah.
Which he always describes as a dream of dark and disturbing things. Because the last 5 minutes of Freaks...
That movie's only like 65 minutes.
This isn't a movie anymore. Yeah. This is someone subconscious on the screen. And obviously, if you're going to give Dracula a spin, 15, 20 years ago, they discovered the Spanish version, which was filmed at the same time on the same sets. By a different director at night, and it actually has better camera work
right. And
some interesting things in it. But again, if Carlos Villaria plays Dracula, and if anything, you have to see the Spanish version to appreciate Lugosi's performance
right. Even
more. Because if maybe here's a use for CGI, we take Lugosi's performance in the Browning version and we graft it into George Melford's version that was made at night, then, you'd have something.
I mean, I think it's almost a hard thing for sort of a new viewer to come to Dracula and appreciate Lugosi's performance because it has been filtered down through cartoons. That is the only interpretation of Dracula now that exists.
Serial commercials in Sesame Street.
Right. And you almost can't appreciate how unbelievably great it is unless you're sort of a student of these things, which I guess we are.
And it single-handedly rescued Universal from bankruptcy.
Yeah.
That on St. Valentine's Day, 1931, and then later in the year when Frankenstein was released, because Frankenstein was made very quickly to cash in on the success of
Dracula.
And
look at all the great movies we got as a result.
Which is why when I go to Universal Studios, I wish they would do more with the monsters to thank them, because if it weren't for the monsters, there wouldn't be a Universal Studios. Next film. Very conventional. But you gotta love it. 1968, Night of the Living Dead.
Yes.
George Romero.
All right.
And I watch it with my class about twice a year. And like the last film on my list, you can watch it 100 times and always see something different, always seize upon a different line of dialogue. Lately, I've been fascinated. At the beginning of the film, we see a brother and sister enter a cemetery. You all know this, of course, because you've all seen the film. And there's this beautiful shot of the trees. Just the trees. And the camera tilts down, and we see Johnny and Barbara walking. And almost like what you said with The Exorcist, does this film know it's a horror film?
Right.
Because it's just very beautiful.
Right.
A little creepy, but very beautiful. And then later in the film, he does something similar. Ben and Barbara are in the house, and they're trying to figure out what to do about the zombie attack, and Barbara is looking for wood that they can use to board up the house, and she brushes up against a music box that has spinning mirrors. And for just a second, we see the music box, and it's playing its little tune, and then we look through the music box at Barbara, and then it closes back up. And a lesser film would not have included it.
Right.
Because it's odd, and one would say distracting, but it's so weird in its offhand way,
right?
That it becomes part of the film you really love.
You had introduced me to an article, and I apologize for not remembering the name or the author of it, but all about Night of the Living Dead, that goes through almost point by point just how revolutionary that movie was and how much it changed horror movies almost forever. That
I think Patrick might be referring to Monster Fan 2000.
Yes, that's the one.
By Rod Bennett and Lynn Hatcher. It's available online. It was part of an amazing magazine, which is now defunct, called Wonder, which was the children's magazine for adults. And that article suggested that Night of the Living Dead is the first modern horror film.
Right.
And that it's espousing a philosophy that is far different,
right,
from Dr. Van Helsing will get us, right, through this.
There's no explanation for the evil. It just is. Your love does not conquer all.
You're a good person, and you try hard, and you get it, and right, you're an awful, hideous person. And not only do you get it, but we later find out you were right.
Right.
The awful guy had right, the right plan, and the hero yeah, was dead wrong. Dead wrong. Infinitely repeatable dialogue.
Yeah.
Pick your favorite line. They're coming to get you, Barbara. Beautiful cinematography. Mm-hmm. For its time, amazing special effects, especially on sure, its budget. Memorable characters. Something that occurred to me last week, because I just showed it in class last week. Clearly all the characters are supposed to be ordinary. But I began to think, we never find out what any of those people do. And films usually like to right, tell us that because right, it's cheap and easy exposition.
Right.
Do any of these people have a job? The film would argue it doesn't matter, but
right,
we never find out.
Yeah.
It's the middle-aged annoying guy.
Right.
His dissatisfied wife.
Right.
Their young child.
Right.
The strong, strapping hero guy. The comatose victim woman. But nothing beyond that.
And the strong, strapping hero guy, it should be said, is a black man. Unheard of. When Night of the Living Dead came out.
True. And one moment in that film that always has gotten a reaction in my class and always will get a reaction. Barbara is hysterical. She wants to go out and find her brother. Ben knows that that's a really bad idea to go out there and get him. She says, you don't understand. We have to go get my brother. He's alone out there. She slaps Ben and Ben hauls off and drops her.
Yeah.
And my students consider themselves pretty hip, and this film was made a long time ago, mm-hmm, but they can't handle. You should hear the reaction to this day.
It's a movie that still not only holds up, but I think still is scary. And a lot of these older horror movies are great, but are not necessarily scary. But I think this is a movie that's still scary for young people. Just be aware, if you've never seen Night of the Living Dead and you're seeking it out, just be aware that lots of bad versions exist and make sure you're getting the right one.
Yeah.
I'm glad you named that because my next movie is actually its sequel, Dawn of the Dead, mm-hmm, which I think is very, very great, in a totally different way.
You have to give Romero credit for not just recycling Dawn of the Dead, far more satiric
right,
in its aim.
Right.
My favorite line always been when we see the zombies trying to get into the mall. They remember this place.
Mm-hmm.
They remember being happy here.
It's every time I go back to it, I see something new. The last time I watched it, which was probably 2 years ago, so much of the movie is critical of the way that, you know, we're just creatures of habit and all the zombies come back to the mall because, like you said, they remember this place. But that even the humans that survive and are living in this mall are still creatures of habit. And there's a great scene where they're in a bank and they walk through the velvet ropes. And I thought that was such a nice touch that,
yeah,
we still do these things that we are used to doing. And there's an unbelievable moment that gets me every time I watch that movie. It goes for a long stretch without any zombie action. It's just following these characters living inside the mall. And they're up on the roof playing
handball.
And the ball bounces off the roof and into the parking lot below. And it's the first time for a long time that you see, holy shit, the place is surrounded by zombies.
Yeah.
And it's such a great reveal of something you already knew.
Yeah.
It's jarring every time.
And like The Thing, when that came out, groundbreaking special effects. Yes. People had never seen gore effects that were that intense. And when that was released, Romero refused to go through the rating system, and it was released unrated. Mm-hmm. So I think you had to be a certain age. And I remember going to see it and getting in and not being of that certain age. Mm-hmm. So I was getting away with something. Mm-hmm. But the helicopter zombie, the motorcyclist who's disemboweled.
Yeah. Nothing gets a bigger jump than the husband taking the bite out of the wife's shoulder, which is in like the first 10 minutes.
And it still looks dead. That's her shoulder. how is that faked? Special effects by Tom Savini. Pretty much the film that really cemented his reputation. Yeah. And very satiric about consumer culture. In the documentary An American Nightmare, Romero suggests that the zombies have had a taste of the good life. They've had McDonald's, and they can't understand why it isn't happening anymore. That's what they're going out. And of course, when the humans are trapped in the mall, one of the first things they do is, let's go shopping.
Right.
And they get to pick anything they want out of the store.
It's such an ambitious movie and sort of so much more epic than Night of the Living Dead, which is told on a very sort of smaller scale. And George Romero, of course, would continue to be as ambitious in future Living Dead movies with incredibly diminishing returns.
And Dawn of the Dead was filmed in a real mall at night when the mall was closed. Mm-hmm. And in the morning, everyone recounted they had to get out because senior citizens would come to do the walk when the weather was inclement.
They had that to get doesn't out of the tell way. You sort of what the movie is poking fun at. Nothing will. I mean,
yeah, it's true.
Zombies out of the mall. The senior citizens have to walk in a circle.
Because the senior citizens remember this place. They remember being happy here. And my final film is Psycho.
Yeah.
I think I've seen Psycho more times than any other film in my life. I think I could perform it for you. I have it memorized.
You're talking about the Gus Van Sant one, right?
No. Oh. No, I am not.
The one with all the jerking off, right?
Stop. More on that later. It is beautiful. It is poetic. Hitchcock made it because he thought if these cheap, bad horror films are cleaning up, maybe one that I make that's actually of quality might make some money, made very quickly with his TV crew in black and white. Paramount didn't want him to make it. Amazing script by Joseph Stefano. There are lines that linger in your ear. There's a shot when John Gavin goes out to the hotel to look for Norman, and Norman is sinking the car of the detective, and Gavin calls for him, and there's an achingly beautiful, heartbreaking, scary, tragic shot where we dolly in on Norman's face, and Tony Perkins turns. Three quarters of his face is in shadow. Mm-hmm. He looks like a skull, and it's one of the scariest things ever, if only for what it evokes about what loneliness and isolation will do to a person.
It's interesting that a lot of these movies that we've named, because there's another movie that audiences that saw it when it originally came out, obviously were just knocked on their asses, and that's so much of what the movie was almost designed to do. It's one of those movies that just really pulls the rug out from under you. That a lot of the movies that we're naming are movies that did that.
Yeah. Revolutionary in their time.
Right. And that really people didn't know how to react to.
Ahead of the curve. And Hitchcock helped that along because apparently, and this is before I was born, people would often go to the movies and walk in at any time and then stay until the next screening got to the point, this is where we came in. Mm-hmm. And Hitchcock had this idea that you had to be in the theater when it started. And then they would close the doors. And if you were late, you'd have to wait for the next show. And it got people curious. Why do we have to see this in this way? And famously, when the film opened in Chicago, it was raining. And there were lines around the block. And Paramount executive said, what do we do? And Hitchcock's famous reply was, buy them umbrellas.
There's that great trailer that tells you nothing. It's just Hitchcock walking around the house and something happened here and something happened here.
And it's so funny because when he gets to the shower, you should have seen the blood. And then when he gets to the staircase, the neck twisted. It was so – well, I won't dwell on it.
I saw the movie. No, it doesn't.
And Another interesting thing is that the trailer contains a trick. At the end of it, Hitchcock reaches and opens the shower curtain, and we see the screaming woman, right. And then it becomes the... That's not Janet Leigh. For the trailer, they filmed Vera Miles.
Right, right.
The actress who plays Lila,
right.
Marion's sister, in the shower, and you don't notice because it's so fast and because Vera Miles has a hell of a scream, but that's... I mean, literally, there's no footage from the film. You might argue that Psycho is the grandfather of all modern horror films, but curiously, I find that modern audiences have no patience for Psycho. It takes too long to get going. That stretch in the middle, and especially the psychologist's explanation at the end.
Which is always going to be a problem. Do you think that because they know what's coming... That's why they are impatient for those first 40 minutes. If you're an audience in the 60s and you don't know where this movie's going, you could be caught up in the Janet Leigh story.
I think that's a big part of it. But also I think films, for better or worse, are getting faster and faster. Yeah. And we don't have much patience for a film that has a deliberate pace and that takes its time. But Psycho is scary as hell and beautiful and heartbreaking and everything a horror film should be.
For my last movie, I kind of went a little bit off the beaten path again. I was trying to, again, predict that you would be picking Universal Monsters. And so I thought, well, what's a classic horror film that perhaps isn't a Universal Monster movie? And so I went with the 31 or 32 version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
With I believe Frederick that's March, 32 or 33.
Okay, I would say 32. Directed by Ruben Mamoulian. That movie is incredible and so unbelievably ahead of its time. And some of that has to do with the fact that it's, you know, sort of pre-code and they could get away with a lot of stuff that they couldn't get away with just a few years later.
Ivy's swinging leg.
Right. But that movie's incredible and Frederick March is great in it. And I just watched it again in anticipation of this podcast, and I'm still amazed, even at some of the transformation scenes that seemingly happen in one take, not necessarily through a series of dissolves, though they do that later in the movie, you know, sort of Wolfman style, but it's panning across his body as he transforms, and it was a very, you know, it had to do with makeup and lighting. And,
yeah, that's the way they did it. And like,
but man, it still plays.
Like Bride of Frankenstein, where at the beginning of the film, Frankenstein's monster has been partially burned, and as the film goes along, his hair grows back. Mm-hmm. The Frederick March, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, is amazing because every time he transforms, it gets worse.
Right.
He gets uglier. He right. gets worse. And it's an amazing performance because, unless I'm missing something, only two people have ever been honored with an Oscar for a horror film. And Frederick March is one of them, although he had to share the award. There was a tie that year. But it's Frederick March and Anthony Hopkins, and I think that's it.
Unless you count Kathy Bates for Misery or Ruth Gordon for Rosemary's Baby.
Let's include both of them and suggest that this is proof alone that the Academy doesn't like horror.
It doesn't. You know, it rarely gets nominated.
No how, no way. No, but that's a great film.
Yeah, and you couldn't see it for a long time. As a kid, I used to check out these books from the library that I just on a never-ending cycle that were just all about famous old monsters, and I was always so drawn to that makeup, the Mr. Hyde makeup from the Frederick March version, and I wanted to get my hands on the movie, and you couldn't for years and years.
And you know why, right?
For the Spencer Tracy one, right?
Exactly. When MGM remade it poorly, they bought the rights to the Paramount version and took it out of circulation. And my favorite story about the Spencer Tracy version is they're filming it. It's really bad. And the short story writer of some repute, Somerset Maugham, was visiting the set one day, and they explained to him what he was watching. And his famous comment was, "Which one is he now?"
Yeah, I was very lucky to, in the 90s, find a Laserdisc of the Frederick March in the cutout bin at Tower Records. Yep. And I was so excited, and that movie blew me away, and it still does every time I watch it. I think it's great.
Now,
worst!
Again, as I said before, there is no end to the bad horror films. 92% of them are awful, god-awful, unwatchable wastes of your time. So it becomes, what criteria are you going to be using? Clueless filmmakers, low budget, ridiculous concept, stupid remake. So we're going to pick up the pace a little bit because, as we discovered in the F This Summer podcast, it's not nearly as fun to make fun of these things as you might think. We just want to forget them. In no particular order, Night of the Lepus, which Channel 2 used to show endlessly when I was a child, very late at night. And Night of the Lepus is a horror movie in the giant creature subgenre. Only the problem is, it's giant bunnies. It's the Easter Bunny. Boo!
I've never seen it, but is it just a lot of, like, forced perspective and models, you know?
It's real bunnies on miniature sets.
Right. Oh,
and
man.
Oddly enough, the film co-stars Janet Leigh, the star of Psycho. So that's crazy serendipity.
One of the best and one of the worst.
They come up with a sound effect for supposedly what bunnies sound like when they're huge. It doesn't help. It's laughable. I think the worst monster in horror movie history.
Well, like you said, it's so hard to pick because so many of them are so bad and set their sights so low almost. You know, am I going to pick on a movie like Jack Frost about the killer snowman? That movie knows it's shit. That's why it exists. So why pick on it? Of course it's terrible. So you have to go with different criteria. So one of the ones I went with, I chose because it is the sole directing effort of famous horror author Stephen King, and that is a movie called Maximum Overdrive.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, we talked about The Shining, one of the best horror movies ever made, directed by arguably, you know, one of the greatest American filmmakers. Stephen King has a problem with it. Okay, asshole, you make a movie. And he makes Maximum Overdrive, a movie about killer cars, not really, machines come alive due to a comet that has green gas around the planet, and one man is killed by a soda machine.
That's the scene I always remember.
Shoots a can at his balls and then his head.
And you've heard the concept of having a tin ear for music.
Mm.
Given the fact that Stephen King has written some wonderful horror novels,
yeah,
it is amazing what a tin ear he has, or a tin eye, for horror he has in that movie. Because the only thing I remember about that film, besides its boredom and pointlessness, is how ugly and mean-spirited some of it is.
Yeah.
And you have to be very careful when you do that, because you sort of have to get the audience on your side.
Right.
And he doesn't.
Right.
It's bad. In fact, the entire last half seems to sort of be a rehash of Assault on Precinct 13,
right,
and Night of the Living Dead.
Right.
The people trapped inside and has to get out and enclosure
and gas up the trucks. He later admitted that he was essentially high on cocaine the whole time, and that he is not proud of the movie at all, and with good reason, because it's a real piece of shit.
No truer words were ever spoken. We mentioned before Plan 9 from Outer Space, which some people consider to be the worst film of all time. I don't think it could be, because it's so much damn fun to watch. But in our worst horror movie list, I will suggest another Ed Wood film, a film I'm doubting any of you have seen. This is truly Ed on the slide. It's called Orgy of the Dead.
Oh, sure.
You've seen it?
I've not seen it. I'm aware of it because I've read Nightmare of Ecstasy, and it spent some time on Orgy of the Dead.
It is beyond low budget.
It's not as sexy as it sounds.
I would, if we were making a list of the least sexy films, I would put it on the list, because actually it's kind of more of a sex film than a horror film.
Right.
A
it
young
was
couple
made very late when he was doing those kinds of movies.
Nudie cuties.
Yeah.
Criswell shows up though. A young couple is making out in a car or something, and they get in a car accident. And instead of going to heaven or hell, they go to this weird purgatorial netherworld where they're going to be tested. And the test winds up being, can you sit through an Ed Wood film as the main actor or actress, they are paraded with a series of tableaux, most of them grade D strippers that represent something. And they're supposed to be sort of in a ghoulish graveyard, hell, purgatory, and it becomes excuses for a bunch of lame burlesque dancing. The color is garish. The dialogue is... It's Ed Wood. Well, no one wrote dialogue like Ed.
But here's the thing about Ed Wood. Like, I couldn't bring myself to put any of his movies on the list because he is a terrible filmmaker.
Yes.
But his movies are so personal. There's so much of him in them that I couldn't bring myself, because at least he has that going for him. Even something like Orgy of the Dead, which is a horrible movie, even hearing you describe it, I know exactly where that came from within Ed Wood.
It's true, and lately I have been playing around with the theory that truly great movies reach a point in themselves that is pure delirium. That at one point or another, a truly great film will go completely off the tracks. Well, hey, all of Ed Wood's films did that
right,
too.
Right.
So, right. Patrick might be right, but it's on my list nonetheless.
I wanted to pick a terrible sequel. There are so many to choose from because horror does nothing but repeat itself in a series of franchises. And I'm so glad you picked Halloween, because one of the ones that I worst movies that I picked was Halloween Resurrection from, I think, 2002. The last Halloween movie that was made sort of in sequence before Rob Zombie remade it. This was when it had switched hands to Miramax.
Was that after H2O?
It was after H2O.
Okay.
It was the only one to come out after H2O. H2O was like, oh, that's a refreshing change of pace. That was not a terrible Halloween movie. It's reminiscent of the old one, and it was okay. It didn't insult me.
So should we follow this path, or?
And they made Halloween Resurrection, which I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's
the one...
They're filming a reality show.
It rips off Blair Witch.
In a house...
Yeah.
The end of the movie is Michael Myers being kicked in the face by Busta Rhymes doing
yes.
Kung Fu.
Yes.
It's one of the worst movies I've ever seen. Not just one of the worst horror movies, but one of the worst movies I've ever seen. I went to a theater and saw it and just felt like, did they finish this? I don't feel like this is done.
I remember seeing that the weekend it opened, and this doesn't happen very often. But halfway through the film, I began to doubt my own existence. I find that's what happens when the film is truly bad. You start to question your whole life path
right.
that led you to the theater to see that film. And that happened during
it's
Halloween
such a depressing thing, because as a horror movie fan, you want to go see any horror movie that comes out, and you're always hoping that this is the one that will justify your love for this genre. And instead, it's a piece of shit like Halloween Resurrection, which is the kind of movie that gives license to everyone who writes off the genre. It's shit like that that gives horror movies a bad name, and it's so upsetting to see such cynical disrespect for the audience that loves these movies.
If we do this and we do this, some people will
Michael
be
Michael Myers is
going.
In it, and you like Busta Rhymes, and you liked Blair Witch, right?
Exactly. And again, when you see a good horror film, there's nothing like it, and it's enough to sustain you through an ocean of shit.
And that movie, I'm sorry, but spoilers for Halloween Resurrection, had the nerve to kill off Laurie Strode in the first 10 or 15 minutes. And fuck that. I don't want to go back and watch Halloween knowing that six movies from now, she's going to die in arguably the worst Halloween movie ever made, worse than Season of the Witch.
And it was almost like Resurrection was acknowledging... Oh, Jamie Lee Curtis came back for H2O, and people like that? She's too expensive.
Horrible, horrible movie.
And we can't get away from this podcast without mentioning, however briefly, the fact that horror films have endless sequels and endless remakes, but there's none quite as pointless as Gus Van Sant's revisiting of Psycho, because some people just won't watch black and white. And, you know... A masturbating Norman Bates, I find much scarier than a Norman Bates who doesn't seem to be doing that.
I didn't understand that perhaps he wanted her sexually in the Alfred Hitchcock version. I needed that literalized on screen. And when I see him masturbating, I understand why he would need to kill her.
Well, The remake makes many things much more specific, and I would suggest it makes other things bizarrely arcane. I deliberately waited until Psycho, the Gus Van Sant version, made it to the dollar show because I was a purist and I'm not going to give those SOBs any of my money. I went to see it, and maybe it was my dinner, maybe it was the popcorn, but that film made me throw up.
Wow.
And not because it was gross or gory scary.
Right.
Halfway through the film, I ran up the aisle, ran into the men's room, and threw up. My critical faculties were rejecting the film like a bad kidney. No other film has ever done that.
Wow.
And as I'm fond of saying, for, what was it, 40 years, the remake was made...
98.
Okay, so almost 40 years. Mm-hmm. For almost 40 years, people have been watching Psycho and enjoying it. And then Van Sant comes along and remakes it. And in the middle of the shower scene, when the character is getting stabbed to death, we cut to a cloudy, stormy sky.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is this predicated on the notion that people for 40 years, or almost 40 years, had watched the shower scene, one of the most famous sequences in the history of film, and said, yeah, that's pretty good. But if you put some scenes in of clouds, then you'd really have something. Likewise, when the detective gets it on the steps...
It's a buffalo, right?
Vance, I always thought it was a cow.
Oh, maybe it's a cow. It's
These are very quick cuts, folks. Right. They're almost subliminal. When the detective gets it on the steps, Van Sant thinks it's necessary to cut to a cow. Very strange.
It's a bad enough idea when you say, I'm going to do a shot-for-shot remake of Psycho. That's a bad idea. But okay, whatever. But then to do... I think we've named the three changes to the movie a shot of a cow, a shot of clouds, Norman Bates masturbating.
Because at the time he made it, he was very adamant in interviews that he was literally timing scenes with a stopwatch because he literally wanted it to be shot for shot.
Why those three changes? Either change a lot or do the thing that you say you're doing and just do a shot for shot remake, which again is pointless. I'm not defending that. But to add these three terrible things, I will never understand.
Was he on cocaine with Stephen King?
It's possible. And that's the first movie he made coming off of all of his Good Will Hunting heat.
Which, again, many directors make a tremendous popular success, which then gives them the right to make the personal film.
The shot-for-shot remake of Psycho,
that more
now
often
with
than
more
that.
Clouds and Cows.
From now on, I'm going to refer to that film as Clouds and Cows. It doesn't even deserve to be called Psycho.
My next choice for one of the worst is a sequel to a movie that's already a giant piece of shit. Unlike Halloween Resurrection, a sequel to a great movie. It's Silent Night, Deadly Night, Part 2. And, of course, Silent Night, Deadly Night is the movie that had everyone up in arms in the 80s because it's about a boy who sees his parents raped and murdered by a guy in a Santa suit and then goes on a killing spree as an adult. And it's just in horrible taste, and it's a terrible, cheap, shitty movie.
I remember the brouhaha about the original.
It was...
Because about 10 years before that, something similar had happened. I think it was called Black Christmas or something. I think that's actually a Bob Clark film, who made... Porky's and A Christmas Story. And
Christmas Evil was another one.
You don't mess with Christmas.
No.
You don't mess you with don't. Christmas.
But Silent Night, Deadly Night 2 somehow manages to be much shittier than Silent Night, Deadly Night, because what it does, and it's fascinating to watch, if you have to see one of these movies, see Part 2, because what Part 2 does is spend half or possibly more, I've never timed it, of its running time showing scenes from the first movie.
Oh, yeah.
It's incredible. So you get two movies in one. You get to see the original shit movie and then the new shit movie. and they're both awful.
And I'm going to borrow a joke that I'm sure everyone's heard before. Silent Night, Deadly Night 2, because Silent Night, Deadly Night left so many unanswered questions.
The tagline on the poster for Silent Night, Deadly Night 2.
It's Christmas again.
I wish. No. Here it is. Prayers won't save you in the silent part of this night. Someone tell me, look, we worked in all of the words.
And you know
what is the silent part of this night?
You know what's weird about that? It sounds like foreigners were asked to come up with an advertising slogan, and then they
prayers won't save you in silent part of this night.
And then they badly translated it into English. It sounds like a fortune cookie.
The silent part of this night.
Oh, my God. Next film on my list, speaking of crazy pointless sequels, Exorcist 2.
Oh,
The Heretic.
I've never seen it.
You are missing out, my friend. William Friedkin, who refused to have anything to do with the sequel, and everyone who was in the original who refused to have anything to do with the sequel, William Friedkin still calls it Exorcist 2 The Hairy Tit, because he says that to make fun of it.
That's a clever play on words, William Friedkin.
Jade. Linda Blair is a little bit older, yeah, and she's having dreams, and we can't get Max von Sydow because he was killed in the original. Oops, spoiler. And we can't get the other Damien, Miller.
Nope, sorry.
It's going to drive me crazy. So we get Richard Burton.
Sure.
Famous
sure.
English actor
sure.
to play another priest who discovers that the demon inhabiting Reagan is this African bad ghost called Pazuzu.
And that's what they should have called it, Exorcist 2 Pazuzu.
And there's another demon that rules Pazuzu.
Sure.
So a great deal of the running time is Richard Burton saying these two words.
That sounds like a Who's on First routine.
Now, I can't remember the first demon.
Pazuzu.
I can't remember the other demon, but let's assume it's like Chechuku. I'm just making that up. I can't remember. So we have one of the most famous actors in the English language. Pachuco can lead me to Pazuzu. Pazuzu can lead me to Pachuco. And I guess the original film was greeted with hoots and catcalls from people who lined up because The Exorcist was a massive hit.
Yeah.
And they pretty much laughed this off the screen, which made Warner Brothers very nervous, and they took the unprecedented step of they recalled all the prints and came up with a new ending, which was even worse. Now, I don't remember which ending was the original ending and which ending was the final ending they chose, but one of them involves a plague of locusts and Linda Blair and Richard Burton with obviously fake locusts flying around them, and Burton is yelling Pazuzu, and it's batshit crazy.
It just showed up on the Netflix instant option, so I may have to give it a look.
I want to give that a spin. Louise Fletcher shows up as a psychologist.
Very good.
Helping Reagan through this because, of course, Ellen Burstyn wisely said, no.
Didn't someone legitimate direct that, though?
Yes. I believe John Borman.
Okay. I think you're right.
And
yikes.
Talk about an assignment. Yeah, you know, in a weird way, given the place that The Exorcist holds in horror film history, it would be like making Hamlet 2.
Right.
Which, of course, is a comedy.
And then for the third one, the author took a shot at directing, right?
Right. And I actually, the book Legion is very interesting and worth a read and full of interesting things. And there's a couple moments in that film that I think are good. George C. Scott takes over the role of Kinderman, the detective from Lee J. Cobb. And it is not a film without merit. That also was subject to massive studio interference. How can we have an exorcist film without an exorcism? The actor who plays Damien in the first one shows up in Legion at the end in a straight jacket, and it's weird. And thank God that Jason Miller, that's his name.
Wow.
Who's actually a playwright. He wrote that Championship Season, which was a big hit on Broadway. But at that point, Jason Miller was still alive and agreed to do reshoots and be in the film. Although Brad Dourif is actually the sort of the demon in that one.
And then, of course, there was a fourth Exorcist movie that was such a mess, they turned it into two movies with two different directors and two different titles. The lesson is, don't do a sequel to The Exorcist. But it's only a matter of time before we get a remake.
It's true. And I know both of those films, I think it was the first one, features a scene of jackals attacking a child, which, of course, breaks my rule of don't get children involved.
My next movie is a movie I saw only recently, and that is another sequel to a very popular contemporary horror franchise, The Final Destination, which is the fourth film in the Final Destination series.
The 3D one?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it came out in 2009. I recently caught it for the first time on HBO, and it's one of the worst things I've ever seen. It's alarmingly incompetent, not just as a horror movie, but just as a movie. The special effects are some of the worst you'll see in a studio film. The actors are beyond wooden. You can't understand how these people were chosen to be in a movie when you know that there are lots of people looking for a break who have to be more talented than this. You have no idea how they were chosen. I don't necessarily get the appeal of the Final Destination series. To me, it's sort of a, you know, a Faces of Death, but with sort of a narrative to it. It's just how many Rube Goldbergian ways can we find to kill teenagers? That being said, I think there's some merit to the second Final Destination movie because it's the only movie that gets how stupid it is, and it is sort of a comedy. And there are things to like about that movie. That director, whose name I think is David Ellis, directed the fourth movie, and it's awful. And I only saw it in 2D. Perhaps the 3D version is outstanding. But it turns out it is not the Final Destination because now they're working on a fifth Final Destination movie.
I remember seeing the trailer many times before it came out and being struck by what low self-esteem they must think that the perceived audience for this film has. Because the big special effect in the trailer was the kids go to a NASCAR race, and a car flies off the track, and a wheel flies off the car, and lands in the crowd, and kills people. And through the wonder of 3D, they made the theater audience the crowd. So maybe I'm old and I don't understand anything. But I go to horror films for a whole bunch of different reasons. But simulating a NASCAR accident right. that takes me out
right.
is not one of them.
Right. And that's what I've never understood about the movies. It's just how many different ways can I watch people die? And it's not scary, and there's no beating it because it's not a thing that can be defeated. It's chance and fate, and death is going to get you no matter what. They're terrible movies, and this is the worst among them.
And finally, thank you for making it this far, is not only the worst horror film ever made, and in the words of Bill Hicks, I can prove this on an Etch-A-Sketch, but I think it's one of the worst films ever made.
Okay.
And I'm pretty sure Patrick will agree with me.
Oh.
It's M. Night Shyamalan's The Happening.
I almost should have done my fifth before this, because this is really the one we should end on.
It's certainly not scary.
No.
It's a lot of things, but it's not scary because you'd really have to be a master. I could probably name only three directors that can make the central conceit work. Big spoiler, folks. It's the wind. And oddly enough, in a lot of penny dreadfuls and gothics, you know, the wind in the shutters or the wind in the trees is used to create atmosphere. But the wind ain't scary.
No. And especially now when you get a scene of people running from the, they attempt to visualize this by having a scene of people running from the wind, and it's catching up with them the way a fireball does in an action movie, but they're able to outrun it.
Who can see the wind, as Donovan once sang. And what's interesting is that this wind, which carries some, I don't know, I fell asleep. The wind is scary. It causes people to do incredibly violent things.
Right.
And at this point, there's plenty of ways to make that work, because right. that part reminded me of, I haven't seen the American remake, but the film Pulse.
Okay.
Where all of a sudden, these really inexplicable, sudden, violent things are happening. Like people throwing themselves off buildings.
Okay.
And that's one of the scariest films I've ever seen.
Okay.
And so there's a way to make that work. But too many characters, a seeming soap opera in the middle of the scary wind that isn't scary. In our small group of friends, one of the lines from the film has become immortalized and as one of the worst lines of dialogue in any film. Don't hold her hand. unless you mean it. And I'm not even going to explain why it's silly, because it doesn't matter. It's so bad it isn't even funny.
Right. It's horribly written. It's horribly acted. It's horribly directed. And again, all the more so because it comes from a director of tremendous ego who has created his own celebrity, who was once nominated for Academy Awards. It is a fall from grace like you've never seen.
And his films clearly just get worse and worse and worse. And I like what you said about The Cult of Celebrity. Again, I can't say this strongly enough. With the greatest director of all time, the greatest screenwriter of all time, the greatest DP, and the greatest actors, you would be hard-pressed to make this work.
Yeah.
And we're far from the greatest in this. We're far out in a field, and I hear the wind.
And once again violates the Pet Sematary rule in that it does horrible things to children.
Leave children out of it.
Yeah.
And Children in Jeopardy? No problem at all.
Sure.
But that's crossing a line.
Right. And so much was made of the film and the advertising when it came out that it was the first R-rated movie from M. Night Shyamalan. But to what effect? It's unbelievably bad, and I almost feel bad following it up because there's no movie worse than The Happening. But I did have to pick a fifth. And speaking of directors who sort of fall from grace, although this director's sort of cult of fandom has eluded me my whole life, it is Dario Argento's Mother of Tears.
And I like Dario. I like his early films.
Yeah.
And I remember going to the Music Box, speaking of the Music Box, to go see it, and so desperately wanting to like it, so desperately wanting to get out of it what I originally got out of Suspiria, for example. And it's partially incoherent. It's muddied. It's really mean-spirited.
Yeah.
For a director who's famous for being mean-spirited.
Yeah.
In the theater, I got the feeling I was watching an unrated version that would never come out on video. And the special effects were bad. So not only was I seeing things that I personally consider offensive, but I was seeing them done poorly.
Right.
By special effects technicians who weren't very good. I'm thinking of certain things being inserted into other things where these things and possibly no thing should ever go. There's a lot of impalements.
Yeah, a truly, truly ugly, nonsensical, terrible movie that goes batshit crazy.
And at the end, we're in some crazy place, and there's a woman up on an altar or something, and I don't know how we got here.
Right.
you know, it's almost like it needed that joke from Grindhouse, real missing.
Right.
Because that's the way it comes across. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. No, I think that's a fine film to end on.
The last thing I'll say, we do need to wrap up, obviously, but it's so many of the directors that we've talked about, be it Dario Argento or George Romero or John Carpenter, or you look at Tobe Hooper or Wes Craven, so many of these horror directors who were once great are now sort of relegated to doing just shitty imitations of the movies that they used to do.
And that's interesting because, again, in this documentary that I really recommend, The American Nightmare, at least two of them say, I don't think they'd let me do that anymore.
Sure.
Which is disturbing.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to hire Wes Craven or John Carpenter, you might want to let them do what they want to do because they're really good at it.
And on that note, we will end. Thank you very much for making it all the way through this show. Hopefully it was entertaining and gave you some ideas of what to watch and what not to watch this Halloween.
It's going to be a great October.
Don't forget to take part in the F Horror Movies Challenge on fthismovie.blogspot.com. 7-word reviews of any horror movie you watch this October.
And we will see you at the Music Box on October 9th.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Bye-bye.